Today is July 23rd, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis working on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Olympic diver Bernie Wrightson over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Bernie, can you begin with your birth name and when and where you were born?
Sure. It's Bernie, and I was born in Randolph Field, Texas, at an Army Air Corps a training base outside of San Antonio.
Oh, okay. And from there, where did you go? So in other words, where did you grow up or spend your childhood?
Most of my childhood was in Denver, Colorado. And that's pretty much from the fourth grade on where I lived.
And what were your earliest sports, or how did you first get involved in any sports?
Oh, I was a YMCA rat, and so I pretty much would go to school from the fourth grade on, and then I would take the public bus to the Denver YMCA, and I would stay there until they threw me out in the evening. And I barely made it home for dinner, and that every day.
Oh, wow.
And so we did all of the sports, swimming, and then there was a Roger Syke who worked as a teacher, and then he was a youth director down there, and he kind of took me under his wing, and they had a diving board that was about a 1.5-inch thick plank of wood covered by 1/4-inch of cocoa matting. And it lasts forever because it didn't bend, but that's what we had. And we began the rudiments of diving right there as a wee little tyke. And then there we went into the gymnasium to where every Friday evening they would have a trapeze. And I did the trapeze, and then I got into gymnastics and played football, baseball. It was, if it's a sport, I would do it. I just had so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Did you have siblings that were also into sports?
Well, my older brother, Terry, he was a swimmer. And so when I was in junior high school, we had one of the only swimming pools in Denver. Was right there at Maury Junior High School. And so then the high school meets would be held there. And so there, starting in the seventh grade, I watched every single high school meet that was in that pool. And that's where my mouth just dropped open, and Buddy Schrodes and some of the old divers that were just the great to me. And I just couldn't get enough of watching them. And that's where it was all born. And then this whole diving thing actually seemed to have been born and solidified somewhere around the eighth grade, where in an English class, we had a requirement, you know, and you had to learn the Dewey Decimal System and find out a library book.
Uh-huh.
Well, we were forced, you said, for your assignment, you have to go into the library and you have to pick a book and then do a report on that book. And then I just went in there and looked for any book on diving. And I got this book on diving about a high school diver who felt that he was set free when he was diving. And I just remember becoming part of that book. And that was all I could think about for weeks. Was doing that and having those feelings, and boy, it was set in my mind, and that's what I wanted to do.
How interesting. What is the name of that book, if you remember?
I don't. I wouldn't even have a clue.
Hmm.
But I just, that those thoughts from that book became so important to me.
Yeah.
And then, I wanted to have those feelings, you know, like you read somebody who has this tremendous experience, and you want to have that well, that's exactly what the way it was for me.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned seeing some divers. What were some of, or who were some of your most major influences at that time?
I would say that, you know, Roger Seif, who at the YMCA, he really kind of took me under his wing and, you know, tried to take this young mind that was traveling in all these different directions and make it think about one thing at a time instead of the 12 that I tended to think about. And so I would say Roger Seif would be, you know, one of my major influences. And then when I got into a junior in high school, I was a gymnast. I was on the gymnastics team, and then I was a swimmer, and then I did diving on the side. And about when I became a junior in high school, I began to take more interest in diving. And then I looked for an instructor, and I Jim Hartman there in Denver gave lessons, and I took two lessons from him, and that didn't kind of work out. And then I went back down to Denver University, and I kind of hung out with their diving team. And there was a guy there by the name of Tom DeLong. And Tom was a football player, and he came from California on a football scholarship to Denver University. And then when he got there, they cut out the program. But he had also been a diver. So if you can, you know, take a look, you know, at a running back who's a diver, you kind of get the idea of Tom DeLong. but yeah, he made it work. A neat guy, just a tremendously influential guy. And then he's the one that actually took all this raw talent from the gymnastics and all these thoughts that I had gotten by reading that book in the eighth grade. And then he's the one that helped me get there. And so once I began working with Tom, it was like an instant transformation to where we had the Denver City Championships in my junior year, and I think I was fourth or fifth place. And then there was a two-week period, and in that two-week period, we worked really hard, and then I won the state championships 2 weeks after that.
Oh.
And then from then on, I didn't lose anything, and my records for the point total stood for I don't know a long time. So it was like a Tom DeLong really helped me. You know, gain the confidence and to get these feelings of soaring. And all of a sudden I began to understand how to use the diving board and I just took off.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is pretty much history. So I have a tremendous amount of gratitude to Tom DeLong, who, by the way, became the best water polo coach at Foothill High School in the nation. He was recognized as the best water polo coach in the nation. And he became one of the best swimming coaches in the state of California for high school.
Oh, how interesting.
He's just a tremendously gifted individual with youths and instruction and teaching and making everybody relax and have fun at a workout or a practice. And he's just a very, very extraordinary person. And we get together from time and again now after all of these years. And so when I finished the Olympic Games, Ray Rude, who's the maker, you know, he owns Duraflex, he would give a diving board to the medalists. And so so what I did is that I had them ship my diving board to Tom DeLong, and he put it up in his backyard where it remains today.
Okay. So you still have that, or he still has that diving board?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, and he has given diving instruction, you know, for decades on that diving board. And if you look at the diving board, you can tell that it's been well used.
Oh, that's a neat story. So, can you describe some of your major competitions and successes on the path to the 68 team trials?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So, just like a brief rundown of your major titles and medals leading up to the 68 trials, so like the Pan
Well,
Am Games.
yeah, you got me there. I had had a good career, and then I think that it started all the way back in the 1964, where I'd won the national championships, just before the tryouts, and then I had an injury and became first alternate on the team, and then from that, I think I had several other championships that I had won, both on the 1, 3, and 10 meter platform. And then, we had just a real nice career, and just lots of fun and traveling around, and it was a great show. We really had a good time.
And so where were you living and what were you doing in the year just prior to the games?
Well, back then we had the draft, and so when I graduated from college, I started a master's program in special education, and after one semester, discovered that wasn't for me. Which is what graduate school is all about. And then I had to enlist in the Navy, otherwise, because my draft number was coming up to be called, and the Army wasn't a very a good option for me. And so once I got into the Navy, I went down to the Naval Training Center there in San Diego, and I was drilling the troops. I was the recruit chief petty officer, so I was the enlisted guy, who was put in charge of my training company because I had a college degree, and I was drilling my company and on the tarmac, and all of a sudden these five guys in a business suit come out onto the tarmac, and my company commander came over and got me, and I went over there and they said, "You're Bernie Wright," and, "Yeah, you're a diver, okay. Well, where do you want to go train?" I go, "Well, now that you asked me, I didn't know." And there was Sammy Lee, that lived up there in Los Angeles. I said, "Well, I guess, thinking I had to be connected to a naval base somewhere." I said, "Well, you could detach me over to Long Beach Naval Station, and then I could practice with Sammy Lee. I think he'd help me," because he was best friend with Dick Smith, who was my coach. And so sure enough, I get orders and I get sent over to Naval Station Long Beach, and I report as a clerk at 7:30 in the morning, and at 10 o'clock I'm detached from all duties, and I go and train the rest of the day. And so I did that for 2 weeks, and it turned out that, there was no atmosphere. It was just me all by myself. There's no camaraderie. There wasn't the whole milieu that I had really, become a champion in. And so I called my detail and I said, "This isn't cutting it. I can't make it. I just cannot make the team if I stay in this environment. I have to go back to Phoenix and train with Dick Smith and the other divers." And so 2 days later, I get orders completely detaching me from all facilities, and they say, "Pick up your paycheck every 2 weeks at Williams Air Force Base outside of Phoenix." And so Kathy and I, we got our housing allowance, and we packed up our car and drove to Phoenix and got a little apartment, and off we went.
Wow. So you were married at the time?
Yep.
And you went to ASU and you dove at ASU under Dick Smith?
Yeah, he was both the he had the Dick Smith Swim Gym, which was his AAU program, and then he was the diving coach for Arizona State University, and he basically picked me up in Denver, and he came through in order to use the platforms at the Air Force Academy, which on the West Coast, that in the Western United States, there was only one 10 meter platform. really, but that you could get to during the wintertime. And he had two girls that he was going to, Patsy Willard and Barbara Talmadge. And what they were going to do was take a tour through Australia and New Zealand, giving exhibitions. And so they had to come practice on the platform. And when they were up at the Air Force Academy, they asked the Academy's diving instructor, well, do you know anybody around here that's a good high school guy? And the guy mentioned my name. And when they went to Denver, before they flew out, they said, he gave me a call and said, could you come down and dive with us? You know, we're going to be at Celebrity Lanes, which was the only other public facility with diving boards. And it was a beautiful indoor facility there in Denver. And I said, sure. And I went down there and I did all of the regular 1 meter dives off of a half meter board. They actually had a board that was, you know, half a meter off the water instead of a full 1 meter.
Mm.
And really impressed Dick. And we had a habit back then. We thought, because we really didn't know anything about diving, we thought the closer you came to the diving board, the better the dive. And this scared the bejesus out of Dick. And he said, look, I really want you to come. I'll get you a scholarship at ASU. I know I can do that. But you have to promise me, don't dive until you come down to Phoenix because you're going to kill yourself. And I did that. And I went down there, and it was a marriage in heaven. And we just thrived together. And it was just a real wonderful experience from the very beginning.
Hmm. So were most of your friends athletes as well, or divers as well?
When, through high school?
Through high school and then college.
Well, obviously, it was, you know, it's a small sport. Diving is a small sport. And in high school, generally, it was, you know, those that were involved in sports, that's who I spent my time around, because I was either training in gymnastics, and I won the, you know, the horizontal bar?
Yeah.
I won the state championships in the horizontal bar in my senior year, and I was like sixth in the all-around, and I had, you know, so I had been meddling in the state championship, so I was a very serious gymnast. I had a nice offer from Doug DeWitt at Denver University. He offered me a partial scholarship in gymnastics there, and I turned that down for my chance at the ASU. And so, yeah, I spent all my time around them. But still, you know, I was in a high school fraternity. And so, you know, I had those associations. And also, when I got to college, I was a colonizer or a charter member to the Phi Gamma Delta fraternity there. And so I lived in a dormitory and became good friends, you know, with my a roommate and the others on my floor. And then through the fraternity, I became very close, you know, with those fraternal brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then with diving. So it was a nice, you know, varied experience. I had a good college career. I was a Blue Key Honor Society and I got the Student Scholar Award for the graduating senior class. So yeah, I was quite involved in my schoolwork too.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So you were married and you were enlisted in the Navy, and then you and your wife left the LA area and went to Phoenix so that you could train with Dick
Right.
Smith and the team. So what was that like?
Oh, it was just perfect because they're in Phoenix. You know, that's Kathy's hometown, and so her family was just like 8 blocks away. And so we went there in late May, and the tryouts were in August. And it was just like before, you know. I wore no uniform. I just picked up a paycheck every 2 weeks at Williams Air Force Base outside of Phoenix, which is right by where the training tank was. And it just couldn't have been any better.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't any better, and it was actually so good that it caused a minor problem.
Oh.
Because yeah, by the time, you know, I went and I, you know, I went to the tryouts and Belmont Plaza Pool there in Long Beach, and I made the Olympic team, and then I came back and celebrated for a week, and then we went to training camp at the Air Force Academy, and then we were down in Mexico City 3 weeks before the competition, and we had the competition, and then I won, and that night after winning, you know, everybody was celebrating, and I heard some guy calling my name from the stands, and I looked up, and there was Dan Turrentine, and Dan was a junior leader, which was, you know, little pre-13-year-old rugrats down at the YMCA. They gave a junior leader program so that we would all think we were becoming leaders. They were actually keeping us off the street and out of problems. That's what they were actually doing. Well, Dan and I were junior leaders together, and he was consulate general there in Guadalajara. And he goes, "Hey, what are you doing after? What are you doing now?" I go, "I don't know." "Well, come on to Guadalajara. We'll show you around town." We go, "Okay, fine." So Kathy and I pack up. We go to Guadalajara for a week. Have a great old time. Great old. I forgot I was in the Navy. Well, and I didn't really, because when I was at the training camp in Colorado Springs, I found out I had qualified for Officer Candidate School. And I had a reporting date, you know, up to Newport, Rhode Island. And I figured, shoot, you know, I got my reporting date. I got nothing else. I'm on my own. But Navy actually didn't see it that way. You know, they had given me all this time out and to train for public relations. Well, now that I won and that my name was big, they wanted to show me around all the different naval functions, you know? Nobody knew where I was.
Oh, no.
I had just forgot to tell you because I hadn't had anything to do for months with the Navy, and nobody called me and said, "Hey, you know, after the contest, you are to do this." Nobody did anything. They just assumed that I was a good soldier and that I would report in. I would call, you know, if I had any change of plans, that I would call my chain of command there in Long Beach, because I was basically temporarily assigned. I was still assigned to Long Beach Naval Station. And, well, anyway, they called all over the country, and they were all over Dick Smith. "Where the hell is that guy? You telling me, where is that?" They called the captain who was in command at the naval station in Long Beach, and they said, "Where is this seaman, this guy that just won a gold medal? Where is he?" I said, "No. Wait a minute, Captain. Did you just say you don't know where one of your men are? Is that what you just told me?" Well, they just pummeled him. And so when we got back after a great week in Guadalajara, we basically were met by three people, who was Kathy's, you know, Kathy's mom and two brothers. And we went and had a little cake and, you know, congratulations, a little cake. And there was just her family and me standing around the table, and I get this call from Dick Smith. And he goes, "Where the hell have you been?" I go, "Well, this buddy of mine, Guadalajara." He goes, "Look, I don't care. They're all over me. You call your base right now." I said, "It's 9 o'clock. And he said, "I don't care what time it is, you come." So I call and they go, "Seaman Ryson, you ought to be here tomorrow at 0800. I said, "I'm in Phoenix." He said, "I don't care if you're in Singapore. You're going to be, well, anyway." So I get up at, you know, 3 a.m. and I drive down there. So, and then I'm sitting in the captain's, I go in the captain's office you know, I mean, if you're an E3 or a seaman and you see a naval captain, I mean, these guys are like gods. And so I'm standing in front of God, and this guy, the veins in his neck are popping out. He's so livid. He goes, "Ryson, you're supposed to be in the brig. You're AWOL. I need to put you in the brig. I can't stay there. I can't put you in the brig because you won a gold medal in the Olympics. And we selected you to go to Officer Candidate School. And I can't stand it. Get out of my office." That was it. So then I went to Officer Candidate School, and on I went.
Oh, wow.
That was really quite a ride.
That's a really, really great story. Very interesting. So going back to the trials, can you describe what the process was there and what the trials were like?
Well, they're the biggest meet ever. At that time in the 60s, U.S. divers, we were just dominant in the world. And so when we went internationally, really nobody really contested us. Generally, we just pretty much would win anything on the international scale. It was just getting onto those teams. That was what was very difficult, because all of us were our biggest competitors. And that was a very, very nervous time for me. And then you qualified, you know, by the national championship, because I had won, I was qualified to go and participate. And 2 days before I left, actually the day before I left, my son was born. And so I basically left the hospital, got into my VW and drove over to Long Beach and competed. And it was really, that was a very stressful competition. And as luck would have it, I came in third. Only the top three go. And so the other two, Jim Henry and Keith Russell, who really beat me handily in the tryout, they were quite chagrined that the roles were reversed at the games, you know, because at that level, you know, one day you're really hot and the other day you're not. And I just happened to be on at the games, and they had a little off day.
Mm. So how did your friends and family react to finding out that you had made the Olympic team?
Well, we were, everybody was really excited. And I think that the biggest thing of note to me is that the Olympics and making the team became a community affair. And that all of those who knew me from college and Phoenix, and from Denver, I was getting telegrams from the governor of Colorado, the mayor of Denver, teachers that I had who felt so proud that I was part of this Olympic team, and so we went to Denver and gave an exhibition there, and it was a very warm reception. It was just everything you would dream about, that you would have this goal and you actually made the goal. And 4 years before, I was first alternate, and they came and did an exhibition in Denver, and I got to sit in a stage and stadium and clap for them. Well, and then 4 years later, it was reversed, and I was in the center of the stage. So it was just really a great experience.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about altitude training. You guys went to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs to dive?
Right, yeah, and it was not for the divers. We had been, they had a trip every year before an Olympics. They'll have at that site a national championship, that country's national. They'll have, you know, a different Olympic expirants. We'll go and compete in their national championship. And then the USOC will send, you know, their cooks and their staffs to go and check out places and make sure that we have a place to live and what food and all that kind of thing. So we had dived, and the altitude in diving is not a problem at all. You know, for the swimmers, the swimmers and the runners, and the kayakers and the canoeists, yeah, it was a big problem. I mean, it was the oxygen deprivation games. It was just unbelievably difficult.
Mm-hmm.
For those athletes, for us, because we're very short bursts of energy, and then it's over, and so altitude doesn't affect us.
Mm-hmm. Well, While you were there in Colorado Springs, just preparing to leave for Mexico City, do you remember anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights or receiving a letter from the Harvard crew team?
I don't.
Do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts?
I don't.
So leading right up to Mexico, like when you arrived in Mexico, what was your impression of Mexico City and the people there?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that you're talking, I was a 24-year-old who'd been broken out of the Navy, and I was free as a bird, and I was part of this Olympic team, which had been a dream forever. And just being part of the team was such a tremendous elation for me. And so most of the political problems that, you've described, that wasn't in my attention span. It really was. It was pretty remote for me. We did hear about the Army machine gunning students, but just briefly, and we weren't captivated by it, and it didn't dominate our conversation because we were athletes there to do athletic events, and that we're just, we're not. We didn't have all of our light switches on, basically. We just tuned in, our eye was just tuned in to the athletic competitions at hand. And so when we got there, basically we were well received. We stayed there in the Olympic Village in little apartments that were grouped together. And so we just had a tremendous amount of team camaraderie. I was housed with Mark Spence and several other swimmers and divers, and we just went to training mass, and then we had the bus there, and it just couldn't have been more idyllic in my mind.
So, what was the Olympic Village like?
Well, to me, it was very grand. It was very wonderful. The food was wonderful. Athletes from all over the world, because I'd competed in the World Student Games, competed in the Pan American Games. We didn't have a lot of the World Championships that they have today. Those were the principal ones. But I had seen and made friends, from different teams, from different countries. And it was, all meeting in the training hall for meals. And oh my gosh, it was so much fun. So much fun. So much fun.
Sounds fun. So, what are your experiences or memories from the opening ceremony?
Well, again, it's that gathering of all the teams, and it was, just watching all of these teams unload from the different buses at the staging area before we walked into the Coliseum, and just noticing really how handsome and how vibrant all of the athletes were. And you really became a respecter of this really is a gathering, of the best from all around the world. And some of us, yeah, were better than others, but all great in their own area. And it just felt so privileged to be there and so excited to be part of it all. And then as you walk into the stadium and you have these thousands of people cheering us all on, and we gathered on it's just the best. It really felt part of something so grand beyond just ourselves, and you really felt, yeah, this is mankind's real movement toward peace amongst all of us.
What a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, you do. You just feel a part of this something so grand and so big, and just everyone has goodwill. And I think we were a little spoiled back then. I think, I don't know. You'd have to look at the stats, but I think CBS was the television provider, and the whole the whole summer games at 44 hours. Well, you know, now you've got 44 hours in it, a 24-hour period for all the coverage you're given now. And, you know, so we had very limited exposure. You know, everything was 16-millimeter except for the TV. They were the only ones that had video. And so it was quite, you know, it was like the good old days. It really was.
Yeah, one of the last Olympics that were like that, I guess.
I think so. And this, you know, we had such a on a personal level, just such a wonderful experience. We were down there 3 weeks before the competition began because they, you know, they wanted us to be down there early, one, for the swimmers to, you know, make sure they were acclimatized to the altitude, and two, to make sure if you were going to get sick from the water or food, get sick early, and you'd be through it. And I talked with my wife on the phone, and Kathy said, "I'm coming down to watch you dive." I said, "You can't. We don't have any money." "We do, and I think we have $300 in the bank." And so while I was training and, you know, on the training camp in Colorado, and then she was staying with her mother, she and Terry, who was 2 months old at the time. And so she said, "No, my mom's going to watch Terry, and I'm coming down there." Well, we had no place for her to stay. We had no tickets. We had nothing. No money. She said, "I'm coming down there." Okay. Well, bring the Pan Am sweats, because in the Pan American Games the year before, you know, the sweat outfit looked exactly the same. Sears got the contract for both of them. Not one change was made. Bring the Pan Am sweat. Okay. Now you bring them. Okay, I will. So I met her at the airplane, or at the airport. She got off the plane. The first thing I said, "Did you bring the sweats?" "Yes." I said, "Then go in the bathroom and put them on." So she goes in the bathroom, puts on the sweats, comes out, and because it really was no security whatsoever, she became an Olympic athlete instantly, giving autographs to people walking by. Swimmers, you know, the swimming girls, I had some of the girls from the swimming team, they came up to me and they go, "I hear your wife is here. Where's she going to stay?" I go, "I don't know. We have an extra bed." So sure enough, she goes and sleeps with the women swimmers.
Oh, wow, that worked out well.
She stayed right there in the Olympic Village. We meet, we go down, you know, to the training hall together. We have our meals there. She gets on the bus. We you know, they take us to the swim stadium. We walk in together. She's in the sweat, giving autographs. She sits on the pool deck with all the divers. And that's the way we went through the game.
That's amazing.
It was so fun. I mean, you know, try that today. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
It isn't going to happen. And so we just had the best time. And so we had the most exciting, you know, finish to the finals. I mean, I did very well in the finals and just, you know, it just capped it off. And so after that event was over, there was Alvaro Gagiola, who won the silver medal in the platform. He was a Mexican diver, and so we had become friends because I had seen him at their national championship and competed against him, you know, in the previous years. And he goes, "I hear your wife is here." "Yes." "Well, where are you guys staying?" "Well, so she's sleeping with the women swimmers, and I'm in my little complex." "Oh, no, after the event, you're staying with us."
Oh,
and
how
so
nice.
He and his wife, Sylvia, gave us their upstairs bedroom after the event. And so we moved into their house, and he hands me his car keys. "There's the car."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so we had the car. We had our own room, you know, because we hadn't been together alone for months. And so that was a lot of fun. And so then afterwards, she just kind of lived in her sweats and I lived in my sweats, and we'd drive up to any venue, volleyball, boxing, you know, rowing, and we would be in our sweats. Sometimes I would wear the medal, and then we would walk up to a venue and everybody would look back, and then everyone, the whole line waiting to get in, moved aside and let us in first. We just went into any venue, could sit anywhere we wanted, just had complete access. It was, oh my God, we had so much fun.
That's
one
amazing.
Day, we were standing on the street corner taking a bus, waiting for a bus. And Kathy and I were just standing there holding hands, talking, and this car just comes to a screeching halt, backs up, they roll down the window, and the woman said, "You Travadista, Travadista," because they had seen me on TV. And I go, "Yeah." And I told them my name. "Oh, yes, yes, come with us. Here, to home, we had dinner. Yeah, we jump in the car. Go to this people's home and dinner." Oh, God, it was just the best. We had so much fun.
Wow. So you got to see a lot of Mexico City. So did you see like the art installations and the pyramids?
No. It was, you know, we were there for the Olympics, and that's pretty much where we spent our time.
Okay.
Going to the different events, you know, after I was done.
So what events did you go to?
I'm sorry?
What events did you go to?
You mean what other sports?
Yes, what events did you see after?
Oh, no. Of course, gymnastics. So we saw several of the gymnastics, and then we saw boxing, and then the most exciting was volleyball. And because I had been adopted by the water polo team, watched the water polo guys play.
How fun.
Yeah, it was just so much fun. So I really got, you know, at these different events, like at the World Student Games, I would, you know, I became very friendly with the gymnastics team. Kind of, we just rocked and rolled around. At the Pan American Games in 67, I got involved with and friendly with the, you know, with the distance walkers. And so you get to, you know, and then the fencers. And we got to share stories about our respective sports. Just so much fun.
That is fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, no, as far as getting out to, you know, to Mexico City at large, no. You know, we did have a good time taking the public bus to, you know, very limited local venues, but most of the time it was just in the building and at the different event venues, and
mm-hmm.
that's where we spent our time.
So what did you think of your event venue?
Oh, it was just beautiful. You know, it was a brand new, the Albuquerque Olympico Stadium was brand new, and it was, to me, it was just beautiful. I think it's sad about 10,000, and boy, they were sitting in the aisles. I mean, it was totally packed, and it was just such an exciting event. And then when Felipe Munoz won the 200-meter breaststroke of Mexico, first gold medal ever, I mean, the whole roof, I swear to you, lifted up 2 feet. That whole stadium erupted in excitement for him, and it was just, oh, you know, just the excitement and the intensity, and the venue was just beautiful and perfect, and just, oh my God, time went to heaven.
Well, can you describe maybe your winning dives and receiving the gold medal?
Well, it's kind of, you know, very, very focused, and it was, you know, the most difficult dive was basically the first. You did three dives in the final. So reverse 2.5, back 2.5, and reverse 1.5, 2.5 twist. And was my last dive, which was the easiest dive for me, which is why I put it last. And so the most difficult dive would be like the reverse and back 2.5. All the other competitors, because, I mean, the pressure, I mean, the Olympics, it's just there's a mystique, and there's this mystical mirage of all past Olympiads and what it really means. I'm telling you, it's a pressure cooker. And so it was that first dive that really determined the course of, you know, of the evening. And I basically went pretty near the last. So my major competitors went before me. And you're just so pumped up. And so there was a guy, Giorgio Cagnotto from Italy, one of the most beautiful divers I've ever seen. I mean, very close to a Greg Louganis. And he's so beautiful and so sharp. And he did this reverse 2.5 that was so high. That was the good news. The bad news was he came out well above the diving board and straight up and down, and he just kept going. And he, poor guy, almost lit flat on his stomach. And so he ended up in fifth place, but because he was so juiced, but in practice, he was just perfect. And so it was watching Giorgio and getting all pumped up and going way too fast. I just took a lot of steam off of it, you know, spun a lot slower to make sure that I made it around and it was the right thing to do. So I benefited from them. And the reverse 2.5 twister was pretty much the best dive of the evening and night. In that finals, and it just felt absolutely perfect, and I was so pumped that I actually remember the entry, but I don't remember feeling water at all. And then from then on, it was just we were walking on clouds, and Kathy was right there, and we shared it all, and it wasn't just me doing it by myself. It was having Kathy right with me, and that was the best. And then after that, we basically had a press conference. And then after that, somebody took my arm and a white coat and said, "You're going to come with me. We're going to get a urine specimen." Well, that was at 6:30. At 9:30, that lab tech and me were still standing in a bathroom. I mean, he had water running over my hand. I was drinking water, because during the contest, I must have gone to the bathroom at least 28 times. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I could not, I was so pumped up, everything was shut down, and I couldn't go. There wasn't anything. I said, finally at 9:30, my wife's waiting for me, we have this room waiting for us. I said, "I got to go." He said, "You're not going anywhere." "Well, I can't go." "Fine. Then you and I, we're going to pull out a cot and we're going to sleep here." Because they were under orders, you get a urine specimen no matter what. And you make sure it's from that athlete. And so when I saw them put out a cot in the middle of the room, I was able to get out about 6 drops of urine, and then I left. it was amazing.
So the 6 drops were enough for their testing purposes?
Enough for their test. Okay. And I said, "Is that enough? Good. See ya." So fun. And then I went back just then finally. Kathy and I got on the bus and we went back to the Olympic Village and you know, it was really eerie because all of a sudden now, you know, I mean, I had been in all these contests. I'd won a lot of contests, you know, both national and internationally. But this time, you know, you're like an Olympic champion. And I just remember the deference that the other divers showed to me immediately. And I couldn't understand it at the time. I didn't understand. I mean, here I've been diving against these guys for years. And all of a sudden, it was different. And it's kind of stayed that way.
How interesting. So you already talked a little bit about what you did after your event, but one more political question before we go to what happened after you got back home. But the Smith and Carlos salute on the medal stand, were you there when that happened?
You know, I was. I was actually sitting in the stands. First to watch those two men run the 200. I mean, it was just, they're just so amazing athletes and just so powerful and fast and just so outstanding. And then when they did the Black Power salute, it was so disappointing. Just very disappointing. First, it took all of us around me. We were so astounded by this. What the hell are they doing? And then we were just angry. Angry as we said, what are they doing? And then the buzz around me and they said, oh, the Black Power, what's that? Oh. Well, shit, they can do that on their own time. This is our time. And they're screwing it up. Get these guys' heads in the right order. And those, myself and the athletes around me, we were just very upset that these guys decided to use our stage. They saw it as theirs. We saw it as ours to make a... a political statement that we thought was totally, totally inappropriate. And Avery Brundage did too, so we sent him home.
So those were your feelings then. Have your feelings changed at all over the years?
Well, obviously, I don't know. I wish that I could have been in either John Carlos or Tommy Smith's presence and listened to them speak about it in years afterwards. I just heard round about that John Carlos, he was, he wished he kind of hadn't done that, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the question much better suited for them. I don't know if you've been able to talk to them or not.
No, not yet.
Yeah, I think that would be a question for them. As far as us, we were determined not to let them ruin, what otherwise was a very idyllic experience as far as athletes were concerned. And I know that, obviously Mexico had a problem, with their student uprising, because that was going around the world, and you have a real authoritarian government that's going to make sure it wasn't going to happen in their country, and they were obviously extraordinarily heavy-handed about it. But that was something that was beyond our purview, and we were so focused on sport that didn't really garner conversation time for me or those around me.
Mm-hmm. And I lied. I have one more political question. And this one's about the Cold War. Did you notice the effects of the Cold War while you were there at the games?
No.
Did you have any interactions with any of the Soviet bloc athletes?
No.
And that's it for my political questions.
If you look at the diving community, we had one or two Russian divers who I had seen in previous contests, and we were quite friendly, and we had no interplay with that or the Cold War effect at all on the athlete level. We, very friendly, and it was quite cordial, and they wanted to have fun, and we wanted to have fun, and we did. And in our sport, in diving, there weren't that many from the Soviet bloc that participated. Melina Dukova from Czechoslovakia, you might put her in that bloc, I'm not sure. She, won her 10-meter platform event. And actually at this last tryout in Seattle, just last month, I met her again for the first time, and she became, she actually defected in 1983 and went to Canada and lived in Vancouver and became a dentist and just wonderful lady.
Oh, how interesting. That's neat that you got to reconnect with her after all this time.
Oh, it was really a lot of fun. I got to tell you, I had a lot of fun. I really have enjoyed the whole Olympic experience. I just was so thrilled. And I just remember in Colorado Springs when we were at that training camp, just to be part of the Olympic team. And then we would go in to Colorado Springs from the Air Force Academy, you know, to go in and have a beer or a Coke or something like that. And people would see us in our uniform and come up to us and ask for our autographs. And we felt so special, you know. And golly, that was, oh, it'd be fun. That's just so much fun.
So you were talking about, I've lost my place here. I'm looking at my notes. So you told me about coming back and the trouble with the Navy, but then what happened after you squared things away with the Navy?
Well, you know, I was squared with the Navy, but with my commanding officer at Naval Station Long Beach, he was totally, totally pissed off. I mean, there's no redeeming. That wasn't anything good. He really wanted to throw me in the brig, and he really couldn't because of the PR involved. And then I went to the Officer Canada School in Newport, Rhode Island, and then I ended up, after getting my commission, I did a year and a half stint at the Naval Academy as their diving coach. And then I went out into the regular fleet because I really wanted to have a Navy experience. And I became a salvage diving officer, and I went through that training of, you know, learning hard hat diving, Jack Brown scuba, that stuff, and then I went through the officer training as communications, and then I became an operations officer on a very small rescue salvage ship that I picked up out of Subic Bay, and then we went over to Vietnam and did some standbys, and I had a very difficult transition. That's when I ran into a lot of mental difficulties because it was just, you know, coming off of this tremendous high as an elite athlete, and then all of a sudden you're on basically an ocean-going tugboat, and then you're in the rough and tumble Navy, and man, I did not do that transition well at all, and so. You know, but it was something that I learned from, and then we had, and that was in 1971. It came down. They had, you know, I was a lieutenant at the time, and they had 15,000 lieutenants, and they didn't need 15,000 lieutenants, and so they let me go because my performance standards weren't good. I had diving problems. I mean, they weren't awful. They have to be in the top tier for them to keep you. And so then I went out and then made my way in the real world.
So I read somewhere that you became a stockbroker?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I started out, you know, just basically knocking around. And then I ended up I started out selling life insurance because I had to do something. I get one move, and I chose Escondido because one of my wife's friends knew a guy who had ownership in a fitness facility. And so I said, sure, I'm an Olympic champion. I can help you with things. He said, you're an Olympic champion. We can really sell our place and we'll sell lots of fitness memberships. And so I get down to Escondido. You get one move. So I moved my whole family down there. We get a little apartment down there. And I go to work, and I find out in about a week and a half that this guy's a crook.
Oh, no. And,
yeah, this guy's a crook. And I said, oh, crap. And so we got no money, no more moves. And so I looked in one ad, and they have this thing, you know, life insurance, you know, Imperial Life of Canada. I said, well, I can do that. So sure enough, they hire me, and I sell life insurance for 2 years. And basically, I was one of their top guys, and I hated it. I just hated it. And so part of the selling was, you know, you have to go find people to buy life insurance policies. Well, one of the training things was, well, you go to YMCA. Well, I love the YMCA. I went to the YMCA, and I kept pounding on them to get them to get their big donors to buy life insurance contracts on themselves to make the YMCA the beneficiaries. Well, I beat them up so bad, they finally said, you know, we can't really help you, but this guy's building this new athletic facility right next to us. You know, it's a tennis, racquetball, and a swimming club. Why don't you go talk to them? Like, get out of here. And so I went over there and beat them up, and they said, God, this guy's beating us up so bad. Why don't you come to work for us and sell our stuff, because you're a real persistent guy. So I started selling their memberships, and I just loved that. And I worked for them for 2 years, and then I was selling memberships to this racquetball tennis club, and I would go to different businesses and beat the snot out of them. Go buy a membership. I never gave up. I was giving talks. I was everywhere. And this one brokerage firm, I drove them nuts. Just nuts. And they go, this guy's so persistent, we need him on our side. And I said, I don't know if I really like this. I'll stay. You know, I'll give him 6 months. And so I worked for him for about 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, it turned out to be a really nice career, and took care of us just fine, and, you know, gave some skills that I really needed for us, and then I was able to help a lot of people, and it was a very, very good career.
Wonderful. So you're still involved in the sport of diving, or the diving community in some way. Can you describe that a little bit?
Pretty much not involved.
Okay.
I come out of the closet for the tryouts, and then other than that, I got involved in our family. We have 2 children, 4 grandchildren, and, we just kind of like have built a nice little place here, and we're just happy as bugs. We're just happier than 2 people ought to be.
So does anyone in your family dive?
No.
Do they participate in any sports?
We got our son, we got him involved in water sports, and then he became actually a water polo player. And so he, you know, to be on the high school water polo team, he also had to be on the swimming team. And so he got involved there. And then Kristen, our daughter, tried gymnastics. And so we, you know, no, diving didn't really make the cut as far as anybody else, but for me, because of my gymnastics background, that's what really made it for me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I'm sorry, say that again?
If you had to give one piece of advice to someone who was hoping to be in the Olympics, what would it be?
Oh, that's a rough one. I mean, that's a rough one, mainly because, you know, you have to qualify to, you know, be invited to the Olympic tryouts. And then those that are in that group, you have to finish in the top 2. I mean, it's a very difficult winnowing process. And I just think that, you know, my advice is to absolutely do everything you can within your power to qualify, and to know that by doing that, you really won. Because whether you really, I mean, dieting is a small, you know, it's a small sport, and it's not a commercially viable sport. I mean, Greg Louganis has been our major standard bearer as far as star power. And, you know, it's just tough to, you know, have national exposure. You're not like a Bruce Jenner or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the real benefit comes from trying and dedicating yourself to one goal. That's the real benefit. And that's what benefits our lives.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like great advice. What are your thoughts on amateurism then in 68 versus the amateur standard now?
Well, it's that we were, I think back in my day, we were pretty naive, you know. For the Jim Thorpe guys, you know, you feel bad for them because of the rest of the world, they weren't playing on that level playing field. But for us, that was our system. And we just have to, it's pretty much like our political system. You know, you just, it's just the forces of nature moves things in a certain way. And back then we were strictly amateurs. I think we had a benefit in that, you know, you do your sporting career and then you move on in your life. Today, I think they're burdened because they're able to get training stipends, they can do speaking engagements, they can get endorsements, and they can prolong their career into their 30s, which many of them do. Well, my gosh, you've been doing this as an elite athlete, you know, for basically 20 years. And so it puts off this formative phase of actually going out into the world and, you know, making a real life. And it puts it off to a very difficult age. And I think that they're having substantial problems because of this. Mm-hmm. So actually, I like our way better. Mm-hmm. Because we're forced, you know, when you're in your 20s, that was a very senior Olympic participant. Today, the average age, I understand, is like well above that. The average age. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know, many of the divers are in their late 20s, early 30s. And I believe that you know, as an elite athlete, where you have crowds wherever you are, people, a lot of adulation, I mean, it kind of gives you a distorted view of life, actually.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And then if you do that into your 30s, I believe you're at a disadvantage. That's my position. Mm-hmm. It may be unfounded, and you, I don't know, what have you, I don't know if you found that from your discussion.
I haven't really, you know, looked into it a lot. Talking to other people, not that many people have talked about that, but it makes sense. To me, you know, it's a very different life being an elite athlete and to do it for so long and then to have to transition. I have read that many do have a problem, a severe problems transitioning. So,
yeah. I had a problem, you know, because you're used to an elite lifestyle and you're used to great receptions and people being honored to be with you, da 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 da, to be in a puke and running around trying to earn some attention by gaining skills that others have been working on while you were diving. And all of a sudden you go from an elite status to an underprivileged status. And then the expectation, well, you're an Olympic champion, so you ought to be good at everything. Well, you know, that pretty much didn't work that way.
Yeah, that must be really hard, that transition.
That was a very difficult time. And then also you have to understand that if you're an elite athlete, you know, there's a lot of compulsive behaviors to get that far. I mean, you have to be doing the same discipline over and over and over, the same training over. That's pretty obsessive compulsive stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden now you're supposed to be balanced, like by some magical transformation. That doesn't happen.
It's a good point.
And you can imagine if you keep those compulsive behaviors up for decades, and then all of a sudden you're supposed to be balanced, well, that's rough.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing the effects of it.
Definitely. Well, what was the impact of being an Olympic athlete and being at a champion at the 68 Games, what was the impact of that on your life, if you had to sum it up?
Well, it was a positive impact, and I've gotten positive benefits from it. Not glaringly so, because basically, it's not a centerpiece, because the centerpiece became my family and my work. And many times I could work with people for a couple, 3 years. They had no clue that I had done this in my earlier years. Nor should they. I mean, it's what can I do to help you now? And that's pretty much the way I've lived my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there, go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any extraordinary benefits from having won a gold medal, I can tell you that.
You haven't?
Nah. Hmm. No, not material, no.
Mm-hmm. But emotional and spiritual, perhaps?
Yeah. It's a big emotional thing. Also, you know, each of our times were for the Atlanta Games and for the games up in L.A. in 84, you know, I got two Olympic torches, and my son ran a leg of the torch relay in 1984, and so that sits in his home. And then for the Atlanta game, I ran a leg of the torch relay and gave that torch to my daughter. And so we've basically been able to involve all of our family in this whole Olympic experience. And it's been really a fun family thing and a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about before we close the interview?
No, I think that the Olympic experience really was an experience of a lifetime that has lasted a lifetime. And it was just so much fun.
It sounds fun. It sounds like you had an amazing time while you were there.
I did.
Wonderful. Well, Bernie, thank you so much for being generous with your time and memories and for sharing them with us today. I'm going to shut off the recorder.